Let's talk about music. My name is Sergio Barrer, and I'm a composer and a pianist with a classical background. My guest today is Alex Shapiro, a composer that is doing right now more electroacoustic music than anything else. But let's have her introduce herself with a little bit of her story as a composer.
Hi, Sergio. It's great to talk to you. And Sergio and I first met in Los Angeles many years ago, so it's nice to reconnect on his podcast. Basically, I have been very fortunate to make my living as a composer for a long time now. And I grew up in New York City, in Manhattan, and I had two major things going for me there. One was growing up in Manhattan and having every kind of music available to me as a kid all the time. And especially once I came of age and was a teenager and could, you know, make my way around the city, whether it was the punk rock scene or Lincoln Center and Carnegie Hall or the Metropolitan Opera or, you know, the Village Vanguard and the Blue Note, whatever it was, I had it, you know, served right up to me, basically. And I was very fortunate. And also in the city were wonderful music schools. So I stayed in the city till I was 21. I went to Manus College of Music one summer, and then I went to, I did go to Aspen Music School and Festival the next couple of summers when I was 16 and 17 as a composer. And then I went to Juilliard Pre-College for about a year or two. And then after that, went to Manhattan School of Music. So I had some of the most wonderful composition studies until I moved out when I was 21, moved out to Los Angeles, where I lived for 24 years. And the first 15 years of that was writing purely commercial music, you know, for low budget features and television and corporate videos and documentaries and all kinds of things in the Wayback Machine, CD-ROMs. This was before the internet. This was in the 80s, you know, 80s into the 90s that I was doing this kind of work. And I had always studied electronic music along with my composing studies because I was always fascinated by it. And I loved building synthesizers and wiring things up and, you know, figuring out what all the patch cords did. I never wrote any particularly good music with that early stuff in the 70s. And I didn't try. I was just fascinated by the process. But it turned out that that experimentation and my, you know, geek tendencies served me really well when I got into commercial music, because then I set up, of course, a project studio, which every composer needs to have, really. And that studio got more and more involved and pretty nice over the years. And then finally, we switched over, you know, in time from analog to, by the mid to late 90s, all digital. And my studio grew with that. And around that time, the mid to late 90s, I also made a change personally in my direction. I decided I had had just about enough of scoring commercial projects, which was a lot of fun musically, because, you know, you write in all kinds of different styles and it was a lot of fun. But I realized I really wanted to write concert music again, which I hadn't done since I was in music school. And I decided to just flip my career when I was about 37, 38. I just left pursuing commercial stuff and decided to create a career kind of out of whole cloth writing concert music. And I began for many years, I wrote chamber music because that was to me the easiest way to sort of start establishing myself and work with musicians and get the pieces heard and recorded. And around that same time, you know, because it was the late 90s, this is when the internet became a thing for all of us. And that also was very fortuitous because I understood programming. I understood how it worked and how to use it to one's advantage as a composer to reach people all over the world and to work with musicians all over the world. And that really was just dumb good timing, you know? And I also had a good sense of business from having done work in Hollywood for so many years. I understood what contracts were. I understood the worth of copyright because under those contracts, everybody else owned the piece, not me. It was these are called work for hire contracts. And so I started a publishing company to handle my own concert music. So I kind of had the business side, you know, up and running too. So I wrote a lot of music and got it out there and was doing that very happily for about 10 years. And during that time, I moved up from Los Angeles to San Juan Island off the coast of Washington State, right on the Canadian border. And that was in about 2007. And later that year, out of the blue, I got a request for a commission from the US Army for a wind band piece. And that was completely out of my wheelhouse. I had no idea about wind band. I don't think I'd ever seen a euphonium. Well, growing up in Manhattan, my school did not have a wind band. And I had not ever been to a wind band concert. I had never written for wind band. And I told the lovely commander, at the time he's major, now he's Lieutenant Colonel Todd Addison. I told him all of this. I said, I'd be thrilled to do this. This is really outside of my comfort zone. Take a risk. But I have to tell you, I don't know what I'm doing. And that apparently was exactly why he wanted me, because he figured I'd write something fresh and new for the medium, right, having heard my chamber music. So I was off and running, and it turns out that opened a huge door to me. I loved writing for this powerful, large ensemble, and then sought out more opportunities to write for these wind bands by attending a big conference later that year in Chicago called the Midwest Clinic, which has about 20,000 attendees in band and orchestra. It's a big deal. And I just figured, well, I only have one piece, but I'd like to do more of this, and I want to meet people. And that ended up turning out really, really well, because I did get a couple of opportunities from attending that conference. So they kind of put me on the map for this new and exciting part of my career. And what's specifically important about this is that the first piece, Homecoming, that I did for the Army, which is still performed, all that, I didn't fail miserably, fortunately, on that one. It was just a great learning experience to have this sonic palette all of a sudden. That piece is pure acoustic. But then as I considered the upcoming commissions for band pieces that were coming in, and I also considered the incredible work that so many of my colleagues were doing and had been doing for a very long time in the wind band field with extraordinary orchestration and beautiful pieces. And I started to get intimidated, thinking, how am I ever going to sound like that? You know, that's they sound amazing. And then I snapped out of it and realized, oh, I don't have to sound like them. They've got that covered. I do not have to sound like that. I can figure out what is my sound. What do I really bring to the table for this repertoire? And of course, that obvious answer was all the work I'd been doing with electronics my whole life, from the time I was 15, and then through commercial music, and then even in my chamber music days, I wrote a few electroacoustic pieces for soloists and duos. And I was off and running. I basically asked my commissioners these first two pieces. The first one is Paper Cut, and the next one was Immersion, and they're very different pieces. And I asked if an electroacoustic piece would be all right, and they both said, sure. And that was still weird back then. There weren't many of them back then. And once again, I was off and running, and I found my voice, and I found something that I really loved is the seamless melding of a large instrumental section of live musicians with a pre-recorded, in my case, a pre-recorded kind of cinematic track that gives great depth and range to add to the incredible sound of the wind band. So that's what I've been doing. I still write chamber music and solo piano music and all that, but many of my more notable commissions over the past 10 or 12 years have been for electroacoustic wind band. So there's my happy story.
Wow. It's interesting. I just want to remark on something, how what one does throughout his life comes back sometimes, you know, in most unexpected ways. Like all your fiddling with the electronic stuff, when you're doing commercial music also, you know, and learning all that, all of a sudden when you went to a concert scene, there it was, you know. It happens to everybody, you know, things that the road is not totally what you think it's going to be.
Absolutely. That's such an important message, is there is no one path and there is no direct path. Most of the time you end up, you know, traveling around that river and around the different bends, and the water keeps changing and you change with it, hopefully. And instead of being rigid about your expectations about what you're going to do and how you're going to do it, stay really open to opportunities and take risks and say yes to them and go with your fear, you know?
Yeah, no. And don't ever think that you are wasting your time. That's the thing. That's what I was going for, because it seemed like, oh, well, I'm doing this stuff that I don't really want to do, and I would rather be doing this and stuff. But then 20 years later, you come back and you say, well, that really helped me, you know? So it's the ways of the path, one's path are very, you know, one doesn't know. One just tries to go ahead. Anyway, I wanted to to ask you then to show us this this piece that I heard called Ascent, which is a very, very interesting example of what you do, of your electroacoustic music. So if you would be so kind to play it for us.
Sure. Let me explain it a little bit. I'll set it up for the listeners so that they know kind of why it was written the way it was. Director of bands at University of Hawaii is a wonderful friend and colleague named Jeffrey Beckman, and he had put together not too long ago, six composers, I was not one of them, six Hawaii-based composers, to write a really beautiful suite for wind band. Actually, I think the first version was for orchestra, and then they made a wind band version called Symphony of the Hawaiian Birds. And so six short movements by six different composers. And Jeffrey decided, you know, I think it would be great to start this off with some kind of, you know, concert opener, you know, whatever that would be, just something to start it all off. And I thought about that. He invited me to do it. And I thought, what a great commission, what a really fun thing to do. I had not done a concert opener before. And so this is a very short piece. It's like 2.5 minutes. And I thought about the nature of birds, because that's what it was following. Things that fly, things that go into the sky, things that go upward. And you'll hear that there's a lot of sound design in there, of everything from birds to jet airplanes. And in live performance, these sounds are very loud, especially the airplanes, to the point where the intent is, the way I've mixed it, is that the audience members almost feel like they have to duck, you know, when the when they hear that jet coming and then later again ascending. And I also decided to take on the challenge, since I was preceding a lot of music that was very strong in melody and themes and rhythms, I decided to challenge myself to write a piece of music that would be emotional and effective and stirring, but not use any melody or any rhythm. So here is Ascent. And that was conductor Jeffrey Beckman with the University of Hawaii Symphonic Wind Ensemble, premiering the piece in Honolulu, right before the pandemic shut everything down. That was the last performance it had. It was scheduled for a bunch more performances. And then I was very lucky to get that live one. That was a live concert recording. So
I did a great job with it. You managed to keep it going up all the time?
Yep. It's completely ascending. And I use a little tool.
This is the greatest ascending scale that I've heard, because I'm still waiting for it to go down, you know?
Exactly. Plus, there's a little psychoacoustic thing in there, which I think might be able to be heard better, you know, in live performance. I'm not sure. But I use something that a lot of film composers make use of called a shepherd tone, which is a little aural trick, A-U-R-A-L trick, that basically it creates a sonic barber pole, if you will, of ascending or descending. You can do it in either direction. Sounds using octave displacement and registration and just fading in and out. So when one ends, the other starts to begin, you know, different octaves. Usually do it with about three octaves. It's a fun technique. And I have that. I programmed that in the track, and that's going on in the background as well, which is pretty cool. So it gives this psychoacoustic sense of just up, 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 up. And I figured that's where you want to go. I didn't want to land, you know. I just sort of fade out with the crickets and the birds. That's it.
And you leave everyone just expecting the music.
That's, you know, what I was hoping.
It's like a perfect prelude, because it's like a prelude. Here, hold on to your seats. You're going to get music. Here we go. Here we come. Here we come. And it's like a few minutes of here we come, and then you're totally ready. That was very interesting. I didn't know about
the shepherd tone.
It's an interesting concept. I'll have to look it up.
Yeah, there's lots of information about it, and it's fun, and there are examples. You can listen to the different versions of it online, it's a fun thing to create. I programmed it, and I had it as part of the track. At first, my intent, my desire, was to actually have the musicians, or some of the musicians, doing the shepherd tone, but it's much more challenging to do live because of the intricacies of fading in and fading out at exactly the right time. And with all this other stuff going on, I figured it was probably more trouble than it was worth, especially for the poor conductor, to have that going, you know, and be responsible for that while balancing all the other chaos, intentional chaos that I had going on with that track. So I decided to just create it myself. But it's in there. It's subtle, you know, it's a subtle little thing.
Yeah, well, I mean,
the great thing about being a composer is there's no rules. We can do anything we want. You know, we can, and as you'll hear in the next piece, it's wildly different. There are no rules.
Yeah. People don't know this, but this is our second attempt at this podcast, because somehow I didn't push the record button the first time. So I know some of the answers to this, but I was very interested in this when we were talking the last time. You say you compose both things at the same time. You're writing the acoustic parts. You are also doing the track, the
digital audio.
Digital audio.
Yep.
How does that work? It's like notes, like a full set of notes. You know, the top part, the audio, and then the bottom part, a mix that you're gonna do later.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's, if you think of a big long piece of manuscript paper that we would know traditionally as composers, you know, where you have your starting with the woodwinds and going down, if it's for orchestra, going down to the strings, or if it's for band, you know, going down to the percussion, and with brass, you know, woodwinds, brass, percussion, double basses. There is an additional section, and that's what the electronics are. That's what the digital audio is. It's an additional and equal section of the large ensemble that creates sounds that I cannot get from the musicians. So it complements the ensemble. I'm not trying to be emulative. I'm not trying to be a fake bassoon or a fake viola or any of that. I've got the musicians to play those parts. But I can create textures, and I can create spatial movement, and I can create very, very high and subsonically low registration pitches and sound worlds that I cannot do with the instrumentalists. And so they complement each other. I write around the frequencies that would be played by the instruments so that there is this sense of space. you know, I take up, you know, certain ranges with the track that I'm not going to step on, you know, with the instruments and vice versa. And the whole thing kind of meshes together. In live performance, it's designed so that it triangulates to the audience. So the people on stage, the conductor and the ensemble, don't hear the full mix. It's not meant for them to hear it. They just chug along and have faith that it's all going to sound good. But I design it so that the end result out in the hall is going to be one of balance. And that's just in the mix. And also in a simple instruction that when you're doing at least my pieces, I don't know about my colleagues with theirs, but with mine, you want the track as loud as the band's going to be. So if they're both equally present, you're going to get that seamless blend. It's quite fun. And yes, everything is written vertically. Now, an analogy I love to use is sculpting. If we were sculpting a bust, let's say a head and a neck, you get the blob of the head on there with the clay and a crude neck. Then maybe you start with a nose. You kind of get the beginnings of a nose. Then you go up to the forehead. But then you go back to the nose to get that a little bit more in context. Then you go down to the jaw. Then back up to the nose to get it a little more in shape. So everything is contextually sculpted. You start with a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there, and you keep adding to it so that it all balances each other. And that's at least the way I compose, you know. And so it's all there in front of me, and I'm writing for a horn here and an oboe there and a double bass thing there and then an electronic blip blop look, you know, black texture weird thing whoosh, and then you know it's all at the same time. And so it's like knitting a sweater or something. I don't knit, but I would imagine that's what knitting's like.
I don't know. Yeah. Knitting seems easier, but it sounds like, you know, it's like the process of everybody has its own process. I know a composer that does a lot of TV composing that he says first he writes it for piano, then he writes for six staffs, you know, for the woodwinds, brass and strings, and then he works it out. I work with a full score and I go first with the melodic line is what takes me places, but I keep doing every two bars. You know, I do the melody two bars and then vertical two bars and two bars and two bars. And that's right. How I work my work. You know, everybody has its own thing.
Exactly. Know? There's no wrong way to do it. You know, it's however one hears and however one wants to, you know, notate that expression, basically. If you're just doing an electronic mix that no musician has to play, notation doesn't matter because you're just working in the audio realm. But the minute you have to make it notate it so that other human beings who you will never meet have to read it down and read it well the way that you intended so that the end result is what you intend, that becomes, trickier and you have to put a lot of thought into that. And yeah, I'm more like you. I go back forth. I just don't, I'm not always, as we just heard, you know, not led by a melody a lot of the time. Sometimes it's a motivic idea of just a gesture or a whoosh or a rhythm or something. In a groove-based piece, for instance, the one we're about to hear, Tight Squeeze, there's an example where I did have a pretty good sense of the groove and laid in a few bars of that before I started writing some of the other things along with it. Because the track in this case is heavily, not entirely, but heavily techno percussion, so electronic percussion, the kind of percussion sounds that you can't get from your live percussion instruments. Very different kind of percussion.
Yeah, for my friends that don't know jazz terminology, what is a groove?
Oh, a groove. A groove basically is kind of a repetitive rhythm that often, if we call it a groove, it often means your body's going to want to move to it. You might want to dance to it. There are repetitive rhythms that can just plod along and be repetitive and rhythmic, but they're not quite a groove, you know, and they're not something you would necessarily move to. A groove is a certain kind of repetitive rhythm.
Okay. Well, why don't we hear that?
Sure. And I'm going to play you another live recording. This was actually a recording from a performance at the Midwest Clinic, of which I spoke earlier. And this is Charlie Mangini, the a conductor of the Vandercook College of Music Symphonic Band. And here they go with Tight Squeeze. Very different piece than Ascent.
Very nice.
Yeah, so there you go. That's a little different than ascent. There are, and there's something very different for anybody listening who is a musician. That is not only a very chromatic theme, you know, da 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 da, but it's a 12-tone row. And no, it goes 12 notes before any of the notes repeat themselves, horizontally, not vertically. I didn't go all the way with the 12-tone serial concept, but it is a 12-tone row that I built that whole piece on. But of course, I harmonized it as I wanted to, and to make it a little bit more like a big band chart. And so I had a lot of fun putting that together, and and keeping it very motivically tight. Motivic meaning the recognizable little snippets of the melody that you hear, and just taking small parts of that and turning them on their ear and developing them, but not straying too far from the material, because hey, it's only a 3-minute piece. You can't go that far. Yeah. You don't want to use too many ideas, no, but you want to keep them interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I was listening to this, I was thinking, you know, when you go into a symphonic band, well, particularly your brand of symphonic band, there is three traditions that you're drawing from. You have the big band tradition, you have the college band tradition, like the ones that play, you know, in a stadium in the intermission of a football game.
The marching bands, yep.
Marching bands. Yep. And then you have your cinematic tradition. And this had a little bit of everything, but I could really hear the big band thing, and I could really hear the cinematic thing. If this would have been part of a James Bond movie, it would have been okay. You know what I mean? It sounded kind of James Bondy to me.
I love it.
I don't know why, but
that's great. Well, there's a little bit. To me, there's a little bit of like a Henry Mancini kind of, you know, vibe in there, sneaking in there somewhere. And yes, believe it or not, somebody did do a marching band arrangement of it as well. So it has been done on the field.
it's an interesting instrument, the symphonic band, because it comes from different traditions.
And yep.
In America, you know, it was the big band jazz era. It was totally American music. It was probably, well, it's not the only authentic American music there is, but it really is really American, you know, from the United States of America. After about 20 seconds, I was tapping my foot to it.
Yep, therein lies the groove. Because there are plenty of other rhythmic pieces that don't make you move like that, you know? So that's when we talk about groove music, folks, that's what we're talking about, something like that. I've done a few groove things, and it's always fun. You know, it's just fun. As I said, there are no rules in music making, and there used to be a fair number of them. And then the internet happened, and now we can all find our niche and create our own niches and find the people that are going to dig what we do and not worry about all the people who aren't. And not have to be put in little categories and you know, little niches to be sold by publishers and record companies and all that, record labels. We can just do our own thing. And that's been very significant for artists for the past 25 years. The ability for desktop publishing and self-publishing and being able to get your work out there and let it sink or swim on its own merit without worrying so much about being approved of by, you know, gatekeepers and higher-ups. Which I just love that. I love the freedom that artists have now.
I agree. There is also a thing that my friend Bernardo Feldman, a composer from Los Angeles, you might have met, you might not, but he's more in the real forward avant-garde. He was with Cage when Cage was here. But he told me one thing about Los Angeles that is very interesting. You know, in Los Angeles, in New York, you have more on your shoulders the weight of Europe. When you go west, that kind of goes. That does, you don't have it as bad.
So I've been saying the same thing for many years. As a New Yorker, I say the exact same thing.
Yeah,
he's absolutely right. There's I call it the proximity to Europe axiom, that the closer you are to Europe, the more the cultural scene around you seems to be connected to that. And Europe in some ways there are some areas of it are avant-garde and other areas are still stuck in like the 1950s and 60s when it comes to some stuff that was going on in concert music. It's an interesting scene there. And there's still a lot of, kind of throwback stuff. Whereas out West, really anything goes. And the further away from Europe you are, it's true. I mean, you look at Lou Harrison or Terry Riley or, some of the West Coast people from, who were doing their thing in the 60s and 70s, who got away from the norms of the East Coast and did and created their own stuff.
Yeah, and definitely there is a freedom, and I used to miss a little bit the European influence, but now I enjoy being in the West Coast and not having to worry too much about that. I was in Minneapolis and in at the end of last year doing a new piece about immigrants, and I you still find a little bit of, I decided that this was going to be a very tonal piece, that I wanted to honor these immigrants, and I wanted it to be tonal, and I wanted it to be performed by high school level choirs. I didn't want to do a virtuosistic piece because I wanted these kids to have access to all these stories that I'm going to tell towards this. And still some people, oh no, that's kind of too simple. And you know what? I'm not writing it for you, man. I'm writing it
exactly
for these guys, I'm writing it for the kids that, first of all, when you start studying music and where you're studying, your basic harmony, you have to start with the basic harmony. Then you can go somewhere, wherever you want, but it's all based on a certain set of principles, and so, I feel that right now, if you want to write something very tonal, you can. And if you want to go and do something without any tonality, I was going to tell you, a friend of mine runs a chamber orchestra in Vienna. And he told me that if your music is not atonal, they won't play it.
That's right. That's right. That's very true. They're stuck in these past judgments of what is considered good by some kind of musical literati. It's silly. It's silly. I mean, there's wonderful tonal, there's wonderful atonal, and there's wonderful pieces that do both simultaneously. I've certainly written in both languages within the same piece, and that's the freedom that we have. And it's sort of unfortunate when any institution or ensemble feels like there's only one legitimate answer. And that's the same thing, by the way, for ensembles that only want to play very deeply tonally centered pieces. They're missing out on a whole world, of expression. Everybody should be really interested in playing everything, because also your audience members, if you're a performing ensemble, your audience is going to be interested in a lot of different things. And some people are going to be more interested in one than the other, and you never know who that is. So when you give people kind of a mixed bag on a program, you're pretty much ensuring that everybody is going to leave that concert having enjoyed something on the program. Something will have spoken to their condition.
And sometimes, even if they don't enjoy it, quote unquote, the fact that they get interested or that their mind gets open in a certain direction, it's worth it.
Absolutely.
You don't know what's going to come out of that. I don't like anyone to tell me what I can do or can't do,
And that's good. As an artist, you shouldn't ever, have to be limited by someone else's stuff. And if someone comes to you, and occasionally I'm sure commissioners do ask a composer to, hey, we want it to sound kind of a certain way. And every composer has the right to say, that's great, I respect that, and I'm not the right person for your commission. Let me suggest some other terrific composers who are, I do that.
Philip Glass, an anecdote about Philip Glass. Once he was asked, so what do you say to people that don't like your music? And he says, well, I say that there's a lot of other composers that you can go to,
Exactly. None of us expect everybody to love what we do. We're focused on attracting the people that do like what we do and right. expanding that circle. That's great. But, you know, the great thing about making a living, a career doing this is it doesn't take that many people to have a sustainable career. It you know, you don't have to have millions of people behind you. So that's very encouraging.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's very nice. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming and chatting with me. I'm sure that I recorded it this time. And I will let you know when it's out, and I hope that we can keep in touch.
Absolutely. It's so fun to talk to you, especially after all these years. And, you know, send me links to your stuff, Sergio. I would love to hear Definitely. More of what you're doing. So keep sending me connections Definitely. To your
We're
music.
Doing just a little pitch. I have gotten involved in a movement. Well, in the movement to help the immigrants in the border. The fact That's that great. I wrote these pieces about immigrants at the end of last year, I went to Minneapolis and I interviewed 25 immigrants. I took the text from their stories and I did a choral piece. And we're going to use that choral piece in order to raise funds to get immigrants help.
That's
These
beautiful.
People that are in the border. Yeah. And that's one of the things that can happen sometimes with music, you know, it can be used for a higher cause than just music.
Absolutely. Activism through music is so important and it has a lot of impact.
It is.
That's fantastic.
Yes, so I'll let you know when the concert is and when the function is. Maybe you can let a couple of people know.
Absolutely. Oh, congratulations on this. What a great project.
Thank you very much. Wow. And it was nice talking to you.
It's great to talk to you, my friend. Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Okay, bye.